Welcome to Failing Up, a podcast where we explore failure.
Why we're afraid of it, why we try to avoid it, and the success that can arise directly from it.
Failure comes in many shapes and forms. It can even mean different things to different people.
This show, Failing Up, intends to explore all aspects. These are the stories of people who have experienced profound failures that ultimately led them to something positive.
We hope this helps us all learn and grow. Thanks for listening.
My name is Eden.
And I'm Guy.
So Alex Capasolatro, thank you very much for being here on Failing Up. Eden, how are you?
I'm good.
It's been a while since we've done a show.
Don't reveal that.
I think we should reveal that. Some people said they missed us.
I know, really?
Yeah, that's gotten good. Some texts and tweets.
We've been just slacking. You know what? We've been trying to get a hold of people, and they just don't reply back.
It's very difficult. You know, the other thing is, I feel like I kind of blew my load with the last show, because we had Alex Sulkin, Danny Zucker, Mike Scully. Like, Danny and Mike are two guys I wanted to have on in the future, but instead I put them all on together, and from there I just couldn't find anybody else for weeks.
I know. That's okay.
It was a good show, though.
It was a good show. And now I do have some other big names lined up that have all been blowing me off, but I anticipate people
We'll force Danny and Mike to come back on.
They can come on individually.
Yeah.
But there's one person I'm really trailing hard, and I think he would be the perfect person for this show, but he's blown me off. Should I just say who it is?
Sure.
His name is Andy Dick.
I know. Well, he blew off decently funny, too.
Yeah, he's a tough guy to nail down. And so the last time I said, Andy, listen, I'm doing something wrong because I contact you every week and you say you're going to do the show and then you don't do the show. What am I doing wrong? What can I do to get you on the show? And he writes back, yes.
Okay.
And I'm like, okay, so that you're clearly not reading my texts anymore at all. It's just because all of my texts before are like, hey, will you do the show this weekend? And then he says yes and then somehow ends up canceling on me. But anyway, I will nail down Andy Dick. I think he has an amazing story. The guy has been to rehab like 18 times.
Okay, so let's not talk about him.
Okay.
And I must say, we can get Danny Zucker back because I saw his car last week when I was at the Simpsons read, and I egged it. And then I sent him a tweet, or I DM'd him a picture, and I was like, hope your car is okay.
Wow. You think that's going to endear him to you?
No, he told me I should have come and said hi.
Oh, see, that would have been fun.
They were filming Modern Family.
That would be fun. So you went to a Simpsons read, and then you almost went to a Modern Family.
I was at the Simpsons read, and by the way, Mike Scully does not work at Simpsons anymore, everybody, which I thought he would still, but he's not there. And across the street from the writer's room, I guess, whatever it was the Modern Family wardrobe department, which is huge. Like, they took up like half a lot.
Wow.
It's just nuts.
That's impressive.
It's also Fia Ficarra's outfits, I'm guessing.
Huh.
Anyway, let's get back to Alex.
Okay, Alex, sorry. So let's talk about you for a little bit, Alex. Let's start at the beginning. Like, when you were a kid, what kind of kid were you? You a normal kid growing up?
I was a pretty screwed up kid.
Were you? What made you so screwed up?
What age are we talking
about? I mean, like, you're, let's say you're 10 years old. You're screwed up at 10 years old?
Why do you think you were screwed up?
So I think it was around when I was 10 when I was diagnosed with diabetes, and that was sort of a life-changing moment. In many aspects, my life just went from being this kid who would just do whatever and have candy and have fun, and all of a sudden I was very regimented. I was having to inject insulin, had to watch what I ate, and I just sort of changed. It was right around when I was 10.
When you get diagnosed with diabetes, which type is it?
Type 1.
Type 1. Okay, so that's like the most serious one, is that right? Okay. Do you, like, at 10 years old, do you realize the severity of it? I'm like, wow, I really got to watch myself? Or is it like, I'll have some candy once in a while?
No. What happens is when you're 10, the whole group are together for a birthday party or for a class trip or something, and everyone's having, you know, cake or cupcakes or something, and you're constantly told no. And so it's just this constant.
Sucks.
Yeah. So
it's like you're an outsider already.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was when I was 10.
That's like funny because, you know, my Jill, my other podcast partner, she has diabetes too, type 1.
Really?
But she found out when she was like 16 or 17. So she like found out as a teenager, which I think is a completely different experience as opposed to being like an adolescent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you carrying around, you have like the testing equipment and all that at this point?
Yep.
Insulin?
Yeah, and it's funny. There's a guy around my age who was diagnosed very young. He was 2 or 3, and he published a book last year called Not Dead Yet. He wasn't supposed to make it this long.
Wow.
So it does change your outlook quite a bit.
But at 10 years old, are you like, at that point, are you looking at your own mortality?
I realized it was in the back of my mind, But interestingly enough, it's part of what got me into technology.
How so?
So if I were diagnosed with diabetes 75 years earlier, insulin, the type of insulin I inject wasn't around, the insulin pump wasn't invented, I probably wouldn't have survived for very long. And so the fact that I'm here is a testament to technology. I think that was part of what really got me into what I do now.
Okay, so it's something that you consciously realize, like, wow, this shit is keeping me alive, essentially.
A lot of us, I don't think, would be here because of technology.
Now,
I don't think I'd be here.
Not on this podcast.
No, definitely. Well, going forward with that, isn't there something now? Like, didn't they essentially cure diabetes? There's something that they invented, technological, that will eliminate the need for you to prick your finger and give yourself insulin and all that.
So every 2 or 3 years, someone comes out with an announcement saying that they've essentially cured diabetes.
Yeah.
It's far from happening, and I just stopped reading those. It's not happening anytime soon.
So you just don't even believe it. And now, so as a kid, does that mess you up? Like, does that change, you think, your relationship with other kids? Like, are you not popular because you're the diabetic kid, or does that not factor in?
That didn't factor in, but I realized that I was very independent from a young age, and I think this was a big reason why.
And so you got into technology. What was your first foray into it?
And when he says technology, everybody, he's using air quotes.
Air quotes, yes, you can't see that.
This is a podcast that people can't see after a mind dive.
That's why you're here for, Eden, to tell him when I do air quotes.
That's all I'm here for.
That's the only reason. So what specifically, like, in technology was interesting to you? What was the first thing that you started doing?
When I was probably 13, I built a website with my brother. It was all about BMX biking. And it just took off, became the number one BMX website at the time. And so started off with websites. From that, I started a t-shirt company for a little bit, an actual magazine we printed. And that led to an actual bike company. So we were making frames, handlebars, seat posts. And that got me really into just physics, engineering. And I spent the next probably 7 or 8 years as a chemist. So I actually left high school at, I think I was 16 or 17. Moved down to D.C. to work for the government, and I was a chemist for quite a while.
How the hell does that happen? Like, first of all, you're 16. I was 16 years old. I don't even want to tell you what I was doing at 16 years old. How do you get tapped by the government? Like, NASA was one of the places you worked for. Yeah, UCLA, Harvard, right? Was another one.
Yeah, so it's funny. When Eden reached out about the show, I started thinking about failure, and she said, no, don't prepare. Like, just come on.
Yeah, don't prepare.
But what was interesting was I had to think about, there was a major failure that really kind of started my career. When I was right around that age, probably 16, there was this NASA summer program for high school students that I thought was awesome. It sounded so cool. I was growing up on the East Coast. This was out in California. And I was so excited. I did everything I could to get in. There's actually a pro BMX bike rider who works for NASA. He wrote me a letter of recommendation.
Wow.
So I thought it was a done deal. And about a week before school let out that year, I got my rejection notice. And so I was a little, I was upset. And I thought, this was going to happen. And what do I do now? And as a result, I reached out to a couple universities nearby. I got a professor that was, I grew up in New York, and this was upstate New York. I got a professor who let me come work in his lab. Turned out he was very influential. As a result of that, I spent part of that summer out in L.A. Attending a conference, and it was there that I met the person who ended up hiring me out of high school.
You're 16 years old, though. Where do you have the wherewithal to go and talk to a professor and say, hey, I know enough about this stuff? And how do you even realize at that point that you know enough? Like, were you just always confident once you started getting into it technologically?
No, it was the opposite. I had no idea what I was doing, so I was just reaching out to everyone. And unlike the Hollywood industry that we live in here, where people basically don't want to talk to you, if you're a kid reaching out to someone who works at MIT or at NASA, they're not used to that. So they're much more open to answering the calls.
That's interesting, though, because even though that you say that, I think Alex Sulkin or someone told us that, like, when they asked them what the biggest, like, advice they could give to someone trying to be a writer in Hollywood is just to, like, have the connections and talk to people and be friends with someone, because they're the ones going to end up hiring you. So, but it's interesting that you were, like, at least had the balls to go ask someone, hey, just talk to me, and I don't know what I'm doing. Or at least you didn't disclose that. You kind of faked it till you made it.
And I'll give you one example. So as a kid, NASA's got this big name, and it sounds like the most impressive place. And so naturally, I found a guy who worked at NASA who I thought, I want to get this guy to help me. He didn't return my first probably 10 emails, none of my phone calls. And then finally, I was independently doing essentially chemistry work in my basement as a kid. I got to a point where I reached out and I said, look, I've already done this. This is what I'm trying to do next. And he responded back saying, holy shit, if you actually did that, let's talk.
Wow.
And so it was a lot of not hearing back, but I just kept going. And I don't really know why. Just
so no
just
means
bored.
Yes, or silence means yes.
So really, you know, you ignored failure, the face of failure, because if he didn't get back to you 10 times, most people are like, you know what? He's not going to get back to me. It's just not going to happen. But you were just pushing forward, essentially.
And it's been that way with everything. My first real job, same thing happened with my last startup raising money. We got rejected 4 or 5 times from the firm that ended up writing us the biggest check. So it's a constant trend.
And we will talk about that, but let's stay like when in your younger days, you're 16 years old. So first you are the webmaster of this BMX site. Did you code the whole site too?
So I grew up sharing a room with my brother, who's 13 months older. He was doing a lot of the coding when I was doing more of the design work. So we sort of would do everything together, but I was more on the creative side.
And then but you said it went from being just a website about BMX to actually you guys selling bikes. So obviously there was some success in that. And then what happened? Did you guys just give up on it? Did the BMX market fall apart?
It was a series of things, but the short answer is the t-shirts actually did very well because the margins are great. And at the time, PacSun and other skateboard, you know, shirt companies were coming out, but there's nothing for BMX. And so we had this captive audience, this website all these people were coming to, and that started making money. When I started the bike company, though, it's really hard to make money on hardware. Just the margins aren't there. Yeah. I was doing a couple dozen units as opposed to thousands of units. And it was fun. I sponsored people. It was, you know, a business, but it never really made a lot of money. And what really got me interested was the engineering behind it. How do we make the stuff lighter, cheaper, stronger? And that really is what turned into the chemistry work.
And so high school, you said you went to work for the government, all that stuff. Did you drop out of high school or did you graduate high school?
So it was kind of a funny story, but first, I can't remember who I spoke to first. It was probably my parents. And they said, if the school's okay with it, then sure. I mean, basically, I had this job down in D.C. It was, you know, 4 hours away from home.
Yeah.
So I went to my teachers and they didn't really know what to say because they've never done this before. So they said, well, if your parents and the superintendent's okay. And it turned out that they were basically those three players, the teachers, the administration, and my parents. And they all said, well, if the other two are okay, then we're okay. So at one point I just said, well, everyone says it's okay, and no one questioned it. So I ended up actually coming back and attending my graduation. And it was kind of funny because people were looking at me like, where have you been?
Right. He's the guy that went to the bathroom sophomore year and came back senior
He's like,
year.
Guys, I just got to take a whiz for a sec.
And did you actually, do the work or did you just kind of graduate because, fuck, you were for NASA. Like, of course you can graduate high school.
It was really fuzzy, but I did take a bunch of AP courses on my own. And with that, I was able to apply it to college. So wow. I do have a high school degree. I did end up applying, getting it to college, and the paperwork looked fine.
Did you take SATs as well?
I did, yes.
How'd you do?
I've always been a really poor test taker.
Okay.
So well enough to get into a good school, but I'm not good with tests.
They're usually not a great measure of your intelligence anyway, I think.
Well, yeah, no, the SAT is not a measure of intelligence. It's a measure of how well you do on SAT type questions.
But they were different. Like, I feel like when I was a kid, maybe I don't know if they changed it for your year, but when I was a kid, it was done differently. And I think maybe it was the last year that they graded it differently.
Yeah.
And then they started to, first of all, I remember the year after they completely eliminated one part that I had to do. I think, the analogy part and the math. Where I was like, that's not fair. I got the harder test. Yeah.
So you were scored on a scale of, to 2,100 or something, or 2,400 or something.
It was, something like that.
Yeah, see, when I did it, it was 1,600, and now it's back to 1,600 again.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. They just changed it back this year, yeah.
Do you have kids? How do you know that?
I don't. I worked for a company called the Princeton Review, and I actually taught SAT verbal and GRE verbal, so that's how I know that stuff. But forget about me. Let's talk about you some more. At what point do you go and start working for Fisker Automotive?
I was about halfway through college, and my...
Oh, I'm sorry. Where'd you go to college?
UCLA.
Okay.
Here in town. It was a long, weird story, by the way, just ending up at UCLA. I was working for the government. I had spent a couple years out of school, and I had this idea for a biomedical company that I thought made a lot of sense. There was a guy who was doing his PhD at UCLA who had a very similar idea. So I enrolled at UCLA, moved out west to start this company. And my first 2.5 years of school, I was basically never there. And so...
Just like high school.
Yeah.
I think you like applying the things and just not doing them or not going to them, but still doing them.
I learned that with grad school. I didn't even bother. So Fisker, what had happened was after 2.5 years of trying to build out this company that was a total failure, everything about it just went wrong.
Bad idea or just execution didn't work out?
Short answer is I was working with a criminal.
Oh, wow.
And long answer can be a very long story. So at the time that stopped, I thought, naively let me focus on school again. This is sort of every 2 to 3 years I decide school should be a focus.
Even though you don't really care for it so much, but...
And I don't remember exactly where it came up, but I read about a couple guys in Orange County that were trying to make cars. This was before Fisker Automotive got started. Before that, they were a company called Fisker Coach Build. And a coach build is basically a company that takes an existing car, they rip apart the insides, they do some cool stuff, and they resell it for a lot more money. And so this was a handful of people, and there were talks about doing an electric version, but not about creating Fisker Automotive. And I just thought, you know, cars, like, this is kind of cool. I haven't done anything with this. It took me 6 solid months in getting told, not just told no, but getting flat out ignored for 6 months from everyone in the company, until one person finally wrote back saying, I'm in Germany for the holidays. Sorry, I can't meet with you. I was like, oh, good. He responded. He's real. And I used that to follow up for another probably 2 months until he agreed to meet me for lunch.
And let me back you up for just 1 second. You learn about this company, and if you don't know Fisker, well, now they were a car company, but did you go, wow, they're cutting edge? Is that what drew you to them?
So Henrik Fisker is a designer. He was a former designer for Aston Martin, designed the DB9, the V8 Vantage, basically James Bond cars. And so this was a group of people making really sexy cars. And honestly, I was hitting them up, SpaceX, a couple other people, but I was also just trying to start random startups and doing a bunch of stuff.
But you weren't going like, oh, Fisker, that's the wave of the future. Or were you?
Not until I joined them. So I was with them while they were basically out fundraising. And before I graduated school, they ended up going out and raising in total over $1 billion. It was a huge fundraise. And so along that process, it was looking at just a handful of scrappy guys in a room getting this idea. And I wasn't the idea guy. I was just coming in, really just learning from what they were doing and seeing how they were able to get all this capital. They ended up hiring over 1,000 people, and it was very vision-oriented. It was all about, you know, how do we change the future of automotive? And that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, that's really
exciting.
They
created really beautiful cars, I think, too, that really showcased that. Like, when you looked at a Fisker, it's like, whoa, that is a sexy car. It really is.
Just
like,
the noise it makes, actually, when it drives by is like...
I know.
Like nothing you've ever heard before.
Which is strange, because I think even car companies these days don't think about that. Like, I don't know. Like, people are like, oh, I just want another Toyota to just, like, go through or whatever. But, like, I think Fisker wanted people to be like, whoa, that's a Fisker. Like,
yeah.
It was very much into
branding. It was almost like a spaceship on wheels.
Exactly.
That's what it felt like to me anyway.
We actually audio engineered the acoustics. There was basically no noise. So there were issues. What if someone is blind? Make sure they can hear the cars coming.
Right.
So everything you hear outside the car is manufactured.
Huh.
That's interesting.
And it wasn't a car noise. It wasn't the traditional, like...
Well, yeah, it's electric cars, so...
More Tron.
Yeah, it had a very, like...
I know, yeah.
What is that thing? So what happened? Why did Fisker not succeed?
Yeah.
So I'll try to...
Is it your fault?
Totally my fault. I'll try to give the short version. Again, I was there for a number of years, but the company was around for about 7. And they're actually back now, by the way.
They are.
Bought out by the Chinese manufacturer who bought A123 batteries, the battery system that we worked with. And they're up and running again. They're still down in Orange County, and they should be manufacturing and producing, I think, this year.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
there was about 2 years of silence in between.
So take that, people that didn't get their first dibs on the Tesla. You guys can now
there's
get
still
them.
Time.
There's still time to get a Fisker.
Those things are super pricey, though.
But
yeah.
The short answer, what went wrong, was half the money that we raised was government financing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was contingent upon hitting certain milestones. We pretty much knew we wouldn't hit that. But at the time, the government was very relaxing about those milestones. But then SolarCity went under, and all of a sudden the political election was going on. This, I think, was in 2008.
Yeah.
And so the right started bashing the left for these bad investments in sustainability, you know, type companies. And as soon as we missed a deadline, that money dried up. And that was about $500 million.
Wow.
So without that money, we just couldn't operate.
So let's go back again. You get this, you finally get in, you talk to somebody at Fisker, right? Then you convince them, hey, I should work for you guys. What do they hire you as?
So... going from a career in chemistry, my degree was actually materials engineering, which, for those of you who don't know, it's the engineering of plastics and metals and ceramics and semiconductors and basically all the materials that we know of. And so in a car company, that's a really interesting position, considering the founders of Fisker were designers. So they cared a lot about the fit, the finish, the materials, and yet most engineers don't really care or think about that, especially automotive engineers.
So they were like the Apple of cars.
Yeah,
exactly.
In a sense, yeah.
So I was hired to sort of be the liaison between design and engineering as someone who's always really loved both disciplines and with materials that touched almost everything in the company.
So that's fun. So you're actually kind of like, you're literally saying, no, the seats should be made out of this, or am I wrong?
Yeah, and the batteries.
The woodwork, the whatever. You're kind of deciding on the design of the interior and exterior.
Yeah, and it's a team effort, but absolutely.
And how old are you at that point?
I started around the time I was probably 19, and then I joined them full-time. I think I was 21 by then.
Okay. And then at what point, and I know they switched names, but then at what point do you co-found Aerogel?
Oh, that was, so the work I did in high school that got me the job for the government was the first work I did with Aerogel.
Okay. And what was it called first?
Aerogel Technologies is the company. For me, though, it was a research project, and one of the people I reached out to when I was a kid was this PhD student at MIT. It was he who ended up starting the company, and I joined him as a co-founder when I left school.
But are you one of the creators of Aerogel?
No. So Aerogel was invented in 1931. For those who don't know, it's got 11 world records, the world's lightest material. It's nicknamed Frozen Smoke. It's really cool stuff. The problem is it's really brittle, so it falls apart if you look at it wrong. So what I did was I helped make it really strong, so basically bulletproof aerogel.
Yeah, and that's like, I mean, it's the future of, right, super lightweight material, essentially, that's super strong at the same time.
Absolutely.
And also, it's pliable. What are some of the, I mean, I think bulletproofing is one of the things it could be used for, right? What other things can, I know it's like a, I feel like it's like a space age kind of.
Is it like a super glue?
So aerogel is a great thermal and acoustic insulator. And so if you're trying to insulate against noise or heat,
it does
a great job. And being lightweight, that means applications in automotive and spaceships
that's
and
perfect.
Airplanes.
Yeah.
And are you still a part of that company?
I'm not.
You're not. Okay. Just, I mean, you. How old are you now?
28 now.
28. And how many different companies have you been a part of at this point? Do you know off the top of your head?
I don't know. There's only been one real one in terms of fundraising, success, and an exit.
At the Pool?
Yep.
Okay. So 2011, you helped create At the Pool. What is it?
So we went through an evolution. We went from, originally the company was called Hyphos, which is an awful Greek word that allegedly means web.
Okay.
And at the time, the idea was, this was when mobile phones were really just beginning to grow. None of them were using location capabilities very well, at least not for social networking.
Yeah.
You had, you know, Facebook and LinkedIn, and I think Instagram might even have started by then. But the idea of how do you move away from just being sucked into your phone and being antisocial towards using your phone to connect with people around you. So when Hyphos became At the Pool, which is really just a rebranding, it was this notion of creating pools that you could essentially discover interesting people through. So a biking pool, a, you know, startups pool, a people who speak French pool. Eden actually was part of the team.
That's how I know Alex.
Really? And so, but then the idea, though, is physical meetups.
So the idea is physical meetups, but very much one-on-one and ad hoc. So rather than being event-oriented, it was much more, you know, you move to Seattle, how do you start meeting people? How do you find people to be, you know, extras in your films, or you're looking for a roommate, maybe you want to find someone to go to the gym with. The idea is, outside of creepy Craigslist or dating sites, there isn't really an easy way to do that.
Okay, so it's not like, oh, every Thursday we meet at the bar to it's more like a online, there is a big online component to it then.
Oh, yeah. But we also threw events, and that was when Eden was starting her comedy career, so we did a bunch of comedy events that Eden was hosting.
Oh, that's cool. Was this your idea?
The initial product, initial company was, but we went through pivots like most startups. At the Pool ultimately became a product called Yeti. And so that was just a team effort through every pivot and every iteration.
So what happens between At the Pool and Yeti? Is this you build it up so much that you end up selling it to somebody? Or did you just create a third iteration of it?
Basically a third iteration, although At the Pool and Yeti coexisted. What was going on was a lot of people would sign up with the intent of meeting people, but the realization is that you actually don't care to meet new people all the time.
Yeah.
You know, something that you might think you want to do, but except for in, you know, rare occasions, or if you're visiting a new town or move to a new town, it's something that you don't want daily. What we found is that people were trying to use the platform to get access to local information more than to directly meet people. So an example would be, if you like rock climbing, rather than necessarily meeting someone to go rock climbing with, you just want to ask local people who like rock climbing, what are the best bouldering spots? What are the best gyms? You know, what do I need to know about rock climbing in you know, South California, Southern California? And so that's really where Yeti came up. Yeti was more about discovering places and things and activities.
Okay. And I'm sorry, did you say you said you sold it or you did not sell Yeti?
We did, and that was all clumped together at the Pool and Yeti.
Okay. What point did you say, how old were you when you sold it, or what year did you sell that?
That was just 1 year ago.
And that's a success for you? Yes, from like beginning to end, you would consider that a success?
A success in terms of we closed the book and that's over. It's hard to consider any technology company a success that doesn't end up a huge, you know, win.
Right.
You know, it's not like this
it's
is
not
the next
Facebook.
It right. wasn't, would you say it wasn't what you, when you first started, envisioned it would be? Like you thought it would, you wanted, or at least what you wanted it to be? The trajectory of where you wanted it to be? Is that what you mean?
A little bit. So there's an interesting thing that happens with startups, especially with software companies. As you're building it out, you're spending a lot of time really looking at what users are doing, and you're trying to both build for the vision, but also build for what people actually want to do. And the problem is those two don't always coincide. So as an example, I'm friends with the guys at Tinder. They often talk publicly about wanting to build a platform that connects people, not just for dating. No one's going to use Tinder for anything other than dating. For us, it was a similar thing. It was growing. It was being successful. But as Edin's saying, it wasn't necessarily the vision that we started with. And then the other thing is we were building a company that had no revenue. And these social products, that's unfortunately the way the model works.
Right.
I really hate fundraising, and I was spending way too much time doing that. So when the opportunity came up to basically move outside that and start what I'm doing now, it was an opportunity I was really excited about.
And so did you use the profits for, or the what's the word I'm looking for? Profits, sure. Use the profits from selling Yeti to start up your latest business?
No, Yeti was mostly an equity deal when it ended anyway. So okay. It wasn't a lot of profits. But I partnered with a friend of mine who was an advisor in the last company who's actually our investor. And so we're not raising any outside capital.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
It makes it easier for you too. Let me go back again one more time. We didn't talk about this. You kind of mentioned this. Age 22. You were one of the people on the Zero Gravity flight, XPRIZE Foundation Zero Gravity flight, alongside Elon Musk, James Cameron, and many others. How the hell does that happen? I mean, that's fucking amazing. I mean, that's the easiest way for me to put that.
Yeah, no, that was a really cool flight.
yeah, okay.
That was fun. I mean, that was a fun flight.
It was okay.
Oh, God, the baggage fees on those flights, man.
One carry-on, that's it.
And the Wi-Fi connection sucked.
It was shit, yeah.
They didn't give us free peanuts.
It's like a four-minute long... No, okay, so tell us about how that all came about.
So both the XPRIZE Foundation and the Zero Gravity Corporation were started by a guy named Peter Diamandis. Peter is one of these prolific MIT, Harvard engineer types who just is starting businesses and loves space. I had read about him, I'd heard about him, and the fact that the XPRIZE Foundation's right here in town... It was obviously something on my radar, but I hadn't actually met him. And so my senior year of college, I saw that he was speaking across campus at the exact time that I had a final, of course.
Yeah.
So blew off the final.
Wow.
And one thing that I've gotten really good at doing, and this is something that everyone should do, as soon as a speaker speaks, they're bombarded afterwards. But beforehand, it's as though no one knows who they are. And so I had looked him up, I knew what he looked like, and I showed up 20 minutes early, and he was just sitting in the front row going through his phone. So I went up and I chatted. I said, I'm a student, you know, just a little bit of my background. I want to work for you. And he kind of looked at me like, okay, I mean, I'm getting ready for my talk. I don't really know who you are, but, you know, here's my email and, like, reach out later. So I waited until a few hours after his talk. I figured he was, you know, not going to be checking email during it. And I sent an email at my resume and just said, you know, hey, I don't know what you're up to, but if you can use someone my background, let me know. And at the time, I had done nothing in sales, nothing in marketing, nothing in PR, and he responded saying, if you want to help us with basically a marketing, PR, and sales project, like, we might be able to make something work. And here I am thinking, I have no idea. I'll tell you in a second what the actual project was, but I'm thinking, I have no idea how to do any of this. I've never had to do any of this. But hell, like, what could go wrong? You know, why not give it a try? And so this was the beginning of what became the flight. So he had said, we want to figure out some type of fundraiser to go out and raise $250,000. We've got the Zero Gravity Corporation, which I run. You know, we don't get it for free, but like we have this at our disposal. Let's figure out something to do. And so we put together the idea of doing this flight. He happened to be pretty good friends with Jim Giannopoulos and CEO of Fox. Jim said, well, let's make this Avatar themed. We'll get, you know, James Cameron involved. And it became this interesting concept of typically a Zero Gravity flight charges $2,000 or $3,000 per ticket. Mm-hmm. It's not cheap, but we wanted to go out and raise $10,000 to $15,000 per ticket. So how do we make that happen? And the whole idea was, well, let's get a bunch of celebrities and people who you know, have the money, and then people who want to meet those people.
Right.
And so we ended up doing a big eBay auction for two of the tickets. I did a silent auction at the Playboy Mansion. Just started getting really creative with how do you sell a $10,000 to $15,000 experience that you can basically get at any other point for a lot less money. Elon Musk had actually gotten married the day before, and rather than a honeymoon, he came on this flight.
Wow.
So he and his wife at the time, it was a really interesting set of people, and honestly, right before the flight, we didn't know who was going to show, but it ended up going very well.
Was it a difficult prospect in the end to sell these things, or did it end up like, oh, well, it's SpaceX, like people want to go on flight?
No, it's a numbers game. There was a lot of rejection. We reached out to everyone from, you know, the CEO and founders of Google and Facebook and Apple and, you know, all these people, and most of them don't respond. It's the same deal.
Yeah.
But if you're trying to sell 10 to 20 tickets, you reach out to, you know, a couple hundred people. The thing, though, that was interesting was it was pitched to me as a free internship where I would basically just do the work. And I said to Peter, look, I'll do this, but I want to get paid this amount, and I want to be on the flight. And I ended up getting both, so it was awesome.
That's amazing.
And so negotiate, people. Don't settle.
he almost walked. He's like, look, I can get any student to do this. I said, then fine, then I don't need it. But he caved, so it was great.
What gives you this confidence to do that? Do you ever think about that? Do you ever go, oh my God, I almost blew it? Like, he could have easily said, F off.
If he said that, I would have done something else. That's the thing.
Do you think you have a lot of confidence?
Yeah.
Are you afraid of failure?
No.
You're not afraid of failure?
No.
Do you have thoughts on failure?
The thing that I'm afraid of is letting other people down. And that's one reason why I hated fundraising and building a company that had investors.
Yeah, because you're relying on other people's money. And
well, not just relying. I didn't want to lose anyone else's money.
Exactly.
That was what really kept me up at night. And so I'm not afraid that the technology is going to fail or that I'm going to fail at what I'm trying to do. But I am afraid of letting other people down. And that's also a motivator.
It's a huge motivator. It's like almost a little bit of fear, right? And so how was the flight? That had to be like amazing, yes? It's a once, literally, well, maybe not for you, but for most people, that's literally once in a lifetime.
And it's been once in my lifetime so far.
Well, so far. Do you have any connection with Elon Musk at this point?
No, I mean, there was a short time when I was exploring working at SpaceX, and I had gotten pretty far down that path, but ultimately decided, oddly enough, to join Fisker instead. It was two were the two I was looking at. And I actually had met Elon the same day that I met Henrik Fisker, and I just liked Henrik a lot more. Elon came across as really cold, not very social, and it was not as obvious then as it is now, but I have a lot of friends who have quit working for him. I don't know anyone who's been fired. And so he creates these environments that are very mission-oriented. They seem amazing in the press, but the actual job is not as glamorous as you think.
Most jobs are not as glamorous as you think.
But no, but I mean, I'm a huge Tesla fan. I was this close to putting my money down on the Model 3. But yeah, too many people did it, though. And I'm like, I'm not going to see a car until 2024, so let's just wait on that. But I am following all, you know, they have the Gigafactory isn't it the biggest factory in the world? It's going to have the largest footprint in the entire world of any factory. And
the second in the U.S.
Who's the largest?
Don't remember.
Oh, you can't just pull that out. No,
in his last keynote, he did mention who the first. It was a GM plant or something.
Interesting. So then, now, 2015, you start a new company. And it was because you're just done with Yeti at that point?
Well, so what had happened was we were, over the 5 years of building up Hyphos and Tap the Pool into Yeti, we had gone through the investment and the fundraising cycle enough to know that it's painful and it takes a long time and it's filled with lots of rejection. And we were getting to a point where we had raised money for At the Pool, but we hadn't raised money for Yeti. And we had to either begin that process or figure out what was next. I went to our existing investors just to kind of get a feel for what was out there. And I said, you know, look, this is how much I think we're going to want to raise. Are you in for reinvesting or what are you thinking? And the general consensus was maybe if there's a big lead investor, but let's see what else is out there. And we had been getting knocked on the door quite a bit by one of the big tech companies up north. Oftentimes these don't really mean anything, but we thought let's have the conversation. And so I went up. So to set the stage, it was around October or November that we realized like this is what we were looking at. From November until the second week of January, you're not able to raise money. Basically Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, and CES,
right.
Investors just go dark. And so we were looking at burning through 2+ months of, you know, capital. And then beginning to start fundraising in January, that was when we said, well, let's set up meetings in January. So took a meeting with the first company that it would have been a very good fit. It seemed, you know, like a very good deal. But when I met with them, it was very apparent that they would just kill the product. You know, it would return some capital, but it wasn't going to be a huge success. And they wanted me to stay on for, I think, at least 4 years. And I would have had to move up north. And so after that meeting, I thought, well, let's keep the conversation going. And there's a lot of due diligence involved. They want to meet everyone. They want to look at the code. In the meantime, the way that I do things is I reach out to people. So I reached out to the top, you know, 5 or 6 tech companies, all the big players that you know of. And I set up acquisition meetings with all of them. And what was really curious was the things that they were most interested in were the machine learning and the artificial intelligence and sort of the user experience concepts that we were going for. And that led me into, so Facebook was the AI team, Google was the Google Now team, with Apple it was the Siri team, sort of the big AI and sort of machine learning teams. And one, I realized that just working for one of those companies was not interesting. If it meant a huge investment or a huge sum of capital that would come back for the team, that would be great. But again, it was, you know, mediocre at best. But I started chatting with one of my advisors who had been building out this artificial intelligence platform for a couple years. And he basically threw out the idea, if I'm able to kind of get out without having to stay involved, maybe we should work together. And that was really the first time in my mind I thought about moving on. The problem is when you're building a startup, it's what you know, blood, sweat, and tears about. Yeah, and the idea of walking away is not easy. I mean, this was, you know, years of not paying rent. Well, like it was ups and downs and emotional roller coasters, and you know, I lost who I thought was my most important person, turned out to be the best thing that we lost him, but then he later on came back to sue us. Like it was all this stuff that was going on, and the idea of just moving on and doing so in a way that was good for the company began to feel like just a burden, a relief of the burden. And so I mentioned to our investors sort of the desire to, let's see if we can sell without my having to stay on, without it being a big company. And one of the investors had said that he knew someone up in, I think it was either Seattle or Portland, that was putting together a group to basically buy companies like this where they would put in capital, hire new people, but keep running it. And I would come on, I would just stay on as an advisor, but I wouldn't be involved day to day. And that seemed very enticing. Now, there was that. There was, I mean, here in town, Snapchat and Whisper and Tinder and all sorts of people we met with. But ultimately, that became just the most compelling deal. And so very quickly, I took 1 week off in between. I was able to sell the company, transition that over. They're still working on it. Product still exists, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. My baby's not dead.
Yeah.
But I was able to then start this new company. And it was crazy how quickly it all came together, because it's kind of like getting out of a 5-year relationship and saying, you know, immediately I'm going to start dating someone new.
Right.
But it was also, my co-founder was a known entity. The idea, you know, over about 3 months was getting formulated, coming together. And it really is a combination of all the things that I was excited about.
Yeah. So it sounds like a situation like when it's right, and you know, and you just got to move forward no matter what the timing is, essentially. Yeah. And so the company is called, I know the product's called Josh, but what is the company called?
The company's called JSTAR.
JSTAR, okay. And essentially, it's an AI system for your home.
Exactly.
And for Simpsons fans, which I'm a huge Simpsons fan, there was an episode where they had something like this. Are you familiar with that? Pierce Brosnan plays the voice of like the house, essentially, and you could say to it, hey, turn up the temperature of the house to 72 degrees, start playing some music, and then turn the lights down to like 70%. And that's kind of what, pretty much what Josh,
exactly what Josh
except
does.
Pierce Brosnan doesn't answer you back. That's the only difference.
So it's funny. He lives up in Malibu, and someone made an introduction at one point. I would love to try to get into the voice. It's not going to happen, but.
Hey, he might.
So you came into this company. This guy had already invented the technology?
Sort of. So Tim is a very, very good engineer's engineer, which means his products are just ugly to the naked eye, but the engineering and the code underneath is brilliant. And so what I was able to do is bring the design and the UX team together. So we're actually split. He's in Denver. And so Denver's where we have a lot of the back-end engineering team. And then Ellie is the creative. So we've got design, mobile development, Android, iOS, all that's happening here. And so it's been about a year that we've been developing the product. And so the technology of the AI, sort of the chatbot, you say, what time is it? You know, what time is it? It can answer, you know, the current time. That is what he had built. But turning that into a product is a whole other matter.
Sure. And so it's literally what I said, though, right? You could tell it to do five different things. It stops and knows to do each one in an order. I mean, there's something big to that in the sense that I tell Siri to do one thing. It's, you know, hey, Siri, turn on the lights. Like, I don't like dogs. It's like, you were not, how does Josh work so much better than Siri? I saw the demos. It does. It works way better than, there's no comparison. Siri's a special needs child compared to Josh.
I think is like Alexa from Echo or the Amazon
one. Yeah.
Because I didn't realize this, because I don't have one, but I went to my friend's house who has Alexa. All of a sudden, she turns into a different person the minute she walks in. She's like, Alexa, play Mozart, this. Alexa, I need more towels. Like, and it's nuts. And I'm like, who is this butler that I don't know?
Do you think this is the wave of the future? Is this where the house is going? Everybody's going to have a smart home eventually?
Yeah, so the biggest problem that Apple made with Siri, and this is the way that AI has been going for a while, they try to do too much. So if they just looked at calendar invites or setting alarms or sending text messages or a couple features, it's actually brilliant. I mean, Siri does amazing things. The problem is they pitch it as something that can basically do anything.
Right.
And so as soon as you start asking it questions that, you know, are a little bit complicated, it's going to fail. We said, long term, we want to make something like that. If you've seen the movie Her, that's kind of the motivation of what we're trying to build. But to get there, we're going to start very small. When you think about what devices you can control in the home, it's really only a handful of devices. So we can make it work a lot better because it's very focused.
And you can take existing technology and put it all together, snap it in essentially, and go, because I have something called, and I don't think you guys support this yet, but I have something called Wink, and that controls my lighting system. And then, you know, you can have something that, like Sonos, right, a sound system, and yada, 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 and
Nest.
Josh put Nest, that's another one that you guys do connect to. What other kind of stuff does it allow you to do?
Well, in terms of device categories, there's lights, there's music, thermostats, locks, you've got TVs, which are really interesting and really tricky to do, right? But essentially, anything that can connect to an app, we can control.
Is it out there? Is it out in the world right now? Or is it in beta testing? Where are we with it?
So we've gotten about a dozen homes beta testing, and then we've pre-ordered or pre-sold a bunch of units. And so we have people who have already put money down, and those are going to be delivered in a couple months.
So tell me more about it. Is it it's a piece of hardware, I would assume,
yep,
that you then have to plug other things in? Or is it's a wireless connection? So it is a wireless connection. How much does it cost?
So what we're doing is we're starting off kind of like Tesla with a very high-end model in the beginning, and then about 18 to 24 months out, looking at doing a mass market version. So the initial version is going to be $10,000.
Okay, it's not horrible.
In this space...
That's like a down payment, though, for a house, can't it?
Yeah.
So in this space...
Not in California.
No.
There are very few homes that cost more than $3 million that don't have some form of automation, whether it's your lights or your music or your AV system. And so those homes typically spend hundreds of thousands of dollars. We're coming in as a very inexpensive option for that, but clearly priced too high for a single room apartment. And that's why the idea is about probably 18 to 24 months out, we drop that down to a couple hundred dollars, which is where Wink is.
And then I'll be able to just have my whole apartment hooked up to, because I live in a one-bedroom apartment. So, but I would like to, I do all that stuff. I walk into my house and I say, Xbox on, and the Xbox turns on.
And then Guy has no dating life.
Well, that's because I'm talking to the Xbox all the time. It's true. How do you approach a project? Because, I mean, it seems like, and maybe I'm wrong, it seems like you're the kind of guy that just goes, you dive right into everything, whether you know what you're doing, or maybe you do know what you're doing before you go in. This is what I'm trying to figure out.
So I knew nothing about home automation when we got started. And this is just a very well-known field. It's been around for a long time. And in a way, it's sort of a group of people that are more or less glorified electricians or plumbers. Any city in the U.S. with large homes, you have professionals that are doing this stuff. And what we found was that there's an organization called CEDIA that they all funnel up into. CEDIA is the sort of CES, they have a big conference, the CES for the smart home. And about 18,000 people attend. So shortly after starting this company, they put in a new CEO. We reached out, became friends, got together a couple times. I'm now on their technology council, and as a result, I went from knowing nothing about the industry to knowing quite a bit. I'm actually writing a white paper for them right now. So part of what you have to do with any startup is, as quickly as possible, get to know just the lay of the land. What's out there? Who's out there? How does it work? Because coming in as an outsider saying, I'm going to be better than you, I mean, it would be like me saying I'm going to write the best sitcom. I don't know anything about sitcom.
Is your goal eventually, though, to be like, hey, Alexa, open up the blinds for me? Not Alexa, Josh, open up the blinds for me? Like, everything, somebody's at the front door, answer it kind of thing? Or is it like, is there a limit to what you're trying to do with it?
For where we want to go, I mean, think about Jarvis from Iron Man or Samantha from the movie Her. The idea
so you want them to fall in love with some guy, right? Some lonely guy.
If you don't fall in love with Josh, we've done something wrong.
Okay. Can we make Josh a girl? What do you think your biggest fear is?
With this company or
in general?
In general.
I mean, in general, it's dying before I've actually made an impact. I would like the stuff I'm building to really become something that matters.
What about your biggest failure?
There have been so many.
Well, I think one that was that had the most loss, perhaps, or possibly like lot, like I guess bounce back, that's been like the greatest.
I mean, the one that had a very big impact for my last company, and my last company was my life for 5 years, was hiring the wrong person. And so the result of hiring the wrong person early on, he walked without giving us any notice at a very critical time when the product was live. He was our lead engineer.
Correct.
And that left us basically in a situation of not having any support when we had a growing user base and we were being written up in TechCrunch and the Next Web and Forbes and whatnot. Having to fill that gap, as well as literally the day he left was the day that I told him our biggest investment was coming in. And really our first investment after a year of not having any success, and having to first save that investment, saying that, you know, we're going to get through this even though we're losing a very, what felt like a very important person, hiring someone to replace them, keeping the product going, which we managed to do very, very successfully. That was, oddly enough, one of the best times with the company. But then he came back to sue us, which I think was a matter of he probably kicked himself for leaving, and then we just continued to do well. He came back to sue us at a time when we were going to raise money again, which if you see in the show Silicon Valley, exactly what happened there, the lawsuit basically means no one's going to invest.
Right.
That type of situation happened. We ended up having to settle, which you basically always have to do. That was a substantial amount of our, you know, capital that we had in the bank. And that whole scenario, and it was just the number of things that rippled as a result of hiring who ultimately was the wrong hire. We didn't know that at the time, but if that had been avoided, all those other things would not have happened. That was just this. And to give you a sense, by the way, he's still looming around. I got an email from one of the acquiring shareholders saying that he had reached out to them after we had sold the company with some more demands, and they basically just ignored him. But that just plagued me for a while, because when you're trying to build a company, lawsuits and just talent, that's crippling. I mean, you're a small team. You don't have a lot of money. And, you know, losing a leg when you have a three-leg stool, you're not going to stand.
Do you consider yourself a success?
Yes, no. I would say no. Which
overall, you're saying no.
Yeah, I mean, just so people often ask me with this company, if we get, you know, our first X dollars for revenue or X number of users, is that success? The problem is you can always add a zero. You know, if you have 10 customers, you want 100. If you want 100, you want 1,000. I don't really ever look at where I am and say this is great. In general, I'm happy in life and I feel good about where I am, but I wouldn't say I feel successful.
You're striving. What's your criteria for success?
So yeah, I was going to ask, what does success mean to you? When do you feel like you've reached success?
I don't know that I ever will. Yeah, I'm not
really?
Sure.
Just you don't have an end game. Like there's not like, oh, if I do this, boom.
Here's my end game. I hope we never sell the company. I hope that we can keep growing it and just do more and more cool things. And I mean, Google is the example of a company I love and the research arms that they have. So the idea of selling for $1 billion would actually almost feel like a failure, because
you're selling out.
Yeah, I want to just keep growing. So I look at someone like Steve Jobs and I say, was he successful? There's always another product. There's always a next chapter until you're done.
Interesting. What kind of advice do you have for somebody who has an idea, who thinks they have a really good idea?
So as quickly as possible, learn as much as you can about the space you're getting into. I've gone into various markets where I knew nothing coming in, but very quickly I just read every piece of material I could read. I spoke to all the experts I could speak to. And if you don't do that, you're not giving the industry respect. And I don't care what the industry is. Every industry has a foundation. It has you know, people have been around for a long time. You need to give it respect. You need to come in saying, I'm new and I'm going to learn. I'm going to tell people I don't know what I'm doing. You have to, you know, bear with me and help me out. But you have to be willing to put in the work. Other than that, I would say be very, very clear about what you're good at and hire amazing people that fill those gaps.
You say put in the work. Are you like a first person in the morning, last person in, out at night kind of? Is that what you're saying? Like you have to have that kind of mentality?
It's Sunday at 4 o'clock. I came from the office today.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you this. What's your favorite charity?
The one that I've been most involved with lately is called Startout, which is a nonprofit for LGBT entrepreneurs, which I can go on for a while why I think it's so interesting. But I actually joined the board not too long ago because I really believe in the mission.
Tell us a little bit about why it's interesting.
Yeah, why is it interesting?
So if you think about the ripple effect of successful businesses, especially businesses that go public, the people they hire, the culture that they spawn, the people they inspire, it's huge. And those businesses have to start somewhere. Typically, they start with some type of fundraising. It's crazy how biased Silicon Valley is in terms of straight white men are typically the ones raising money. It's a boys' club.
Just look at Silicon Valley, the TV show.
Yeah, exactly. And so breaking that stigma, I think, is really important. And the community that I've engaged with and that I'm part of is the LGBT community. And so whether you're, you know, gay or lesbian, or the transgender community is a whole nother set of issues. If you think about going in and pitching a bunch of Harvard white middle-aged lawyers
totally
to raise money, it's crazy.
Huh. All right. Well, I'm going to give $150 to your charity. Startout is what it's called. Is it like startout.com? Do we know?
.org.
Okay. I will be on there, and that will be who we are contributing to this week. Yes. So, Alex Capisalatro, I said it twice correctly, Eden. Thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it. Damn, you're successful. Congratulations for all of your success and more in the future, hopefully. And yeah, thanks for being on Failing Up today. Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.